Welcome to Power Play, the Valentine's Day edition, which means our MPs will be particularly lovey-dovey. Instead of engaging in a war of the roses over partisan issues, they're coming right up. Also ahead, the Canadian Forces watchdog is fed up with studies and leveled a blast at politicians for foot-dragging on services for veterans. We will ask the politicians why 14 studies aren't enough to engage in some action for a change. We will go to British Columbia for the continuing aftershocks from the Rocky Mountain showdown with Alberta, an issue the Premier seems anxious to ignore. Our eye on BC is standing by. And public trust is becoming increasingly scarce around the world. We will look at how Canadians view their trustworthiness in government, yes, the media, and business. Trust me, it's not good news. But first, it's been a week-long theme as the government scrambles a response on the Boucher verdict. Today, MPs held a debate in the Commons on the issue while the Prime Minister put forward a blueprint for clearer Indigenous Canadian rights and rule of law.
Today, I am pleased to announce that the government will develop, in full partnership with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people, a new recognition and implementation of Indigenous rights framework that will include new ways to recognize and implement Indigenous rights. This will include new recognition and implementation of rights legislation. Going forward, recognition of rights will guide all government interactions with Indigenous peoples.
All right, let's give this a grounding in reality. I'm going to bring in one of Canada's Indigenous leaders. Clément Chartier is president of the Métis National Council, and he joins us from Vancouver. Mr. Chartier, a lot of lofty wording in the Prime Minister's speech today, but what did you hear that you thought was important?
Well, Don, it could be a sweetheart deal, but we still need to see how it will roll out. I'm particularly pleased that they are moving forward. The government is moving forward with a framework which will address the implementation of Section 35. I've been engaged in that process since 1981, was one of the signatories to the first amendments to Canada's Patriotic Constitution in 1983. For the Métis Nation, we've been marginalized a long time, and we've been getting a lot of attention over the last 2 decades, and particularly over the last 2 years. So we have a great hope that the framework will finally set out a path forward directly with the Métis Nation. We are looking, of course, at budget 2018, which we believe is the Métis Nation budget, because we've been more or less excluded from the first two budgets. This year, we believe, will be our turn. So we'll see what happens on that budget on February 27th. And we hope, it's going to be what we expect it to be, and that we engage in this new process, in a more meaningful, grounded way for our people.
Yeah, I want to get a clearer picture from you, if I can. You talked about a consultation leading to a framework, leading to a way forward, but I'm just trying to see the end destination from this. I'm trying to figure out what a framework looks like when it's put into action. Can you tell me what you think it looks like?
Well, I really haven't had any engagement in this, but what I can see is that this new framework is going to take what's been put in place over the last 2 years. We have the permanent bilateral mechanism. We signed the Canada-Métis Nation Accord in April of last year. We have Section 35 rights reconciliation tables with our five governing members. It's kind of almost ad hoc in a sense. I think the new framework, as I understand it, is going to take everything we've been doing since 1982 and putting it into a framework which will have possibly the legislation behind it, or perhaps a royal proclamation, but something that's going to formalize the process, which gives it more, I guess, authority moving forward and greater engagement between the government and between Indigenous peoples and Canadians generally. So to me, that's a good thing. Like I say, I've been engaged in this since basically 1982, when the Act came into force, and it's been, in a sense, lacking some specificity in terms of direction and having a firm footing going forward. I believe, this Parliament acting together, will set a framework that takes us forward regardless of which, party forms government, because we need to have, consistency going forward. And this implementation, recognition, framework, I believe, will accomplish that. But for the Métis Nation, we need to be in a space where we can move forward on our right of self-determination, have, you know, restitution for the wrongs that happened in the past. You know, we were displaced, you know, from our homelands. And,
right.
and there's a lot of issues outstanding for us.
But, you know, Indigenous people across Canada have been given words like this over and over again. And I want to make sure I understand you right. You don't believe this is a consultation that's going to end up on a dusty shelf somewhere. You sound more optimistic than perhaps you have a right to, that this is going to produce real change, real Indigenous self-government. Am I reading you right on that one?
Well, that's correct. As I say, I've been at this, you know, a long time. And
yes,
of course,
have.
We always have to have hope, you know, and so I believe this is our opportunity. So I believe firmly that, again, this framework will set us in the right direction, but budget 2018 will be, you know, the proof in the pudding, as they say. If this is not the Métis Nation turn at the budget, then I'd be more skeptical going forward because, you know, it's time for, you know, action and, you know, not so much, you know, flowery language, although we have gone, you know, some ways forward, you know, over the past 2 years. So we'll see. Again,
all right.
February 2017 will be the day that we can give some greater specificity to our aspirations.
Okay, the proof is in the money. All right, thank you, Mr. Chargé. I appreciate your time on this one.
Yes, thank you, Don.
All right, let's go straight to the MPs for their interpretation. Marco Mendicino, a Liberal Parliamentary Secretary for Justice. Candace Bergen is the Conservative House Leader. Tracy Ramsay is the NDP's Deputy House...
International Trade Critic.
International
and
Trade...
And Deputy Labor Critic.
You just changed a few roles. I should know this by now.
Happy Valentine's.
Happy Valentine's Day. Candace, I got to get your thoughts on this framework for consultation. Does this sound like a plan of action or kicking the can down the road?
Well, you know, we heard again the Prime Minister stand up and deliver a very beautiful speech, a lot of very flowery words, as Mr. Chartier described them. My concern, frankly, is when the government, a lot of the promises that the government has made, not just to First Nations people, but to a lot of people, they've not followed through on. And when it comes to First Nations people, one of the first things that they actually did when they formed government was they took away the rights for individual First Nations people to hold their own leaders to account. In my mind, and I think for a lot of Canadians, you know, we can talk about these big flowery things, but if we actually want to help First Nations people, wouldn't the basis of that giving power and the ability to, whether it's hold your government to account, whether it's to be able to get a job and earn money off the reserve and be successful, those are foundational to all of our success. So it does concern me when I hear a Prime Minister, you know, deliver another beautiful speech in the House of Commons, but his actions don't line up.
All right. I'm anxious to see what you think, Tracy, because I know your critic, Romeo Seganash, gave a beautiful response, but he didn't exactly sound like, sort of like, I'll believe it when I see it kind of theme.
Well, he mentioned the hope as well that we just heard from Mr. Chartier, that, you know, there is hope. And of course, we're there to work with the government in advancing the rights of Indigenous people. There are many things we can do right now, which Romeo pointed out in his very beautiful speech. He has a private members bill right now that we're putting through that will implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. This is the basis. You know, recognizing that the human rights are Indigenous rights in our country is critical to the work that we're doing. But there are many, many things that could happen right now. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has many, many recommendations that could be implemented right now. Mm-hmm. I hope that this framework doesn't mean that we're going to stall on all of those good things that we could do right now, that we get to work on those, and that this framework is truly inclusive and recognizes self-determination of Indigenous people.
Marco, help me check my cynicism at the door here. You know, more than halfway through your term, you suddenly bring up this framework, which looks like it could take a long time to actually become a framework and then become implemented. Why take so long, and how do you Are you sure you can see it done in this mandate?
Well, it's not sudden, and the work of reconciliation started from before the time that we took office. And I was encouraged to hear Chief Clem Chartier, who I had the honor of meeting with in a bilat meeting earlier this summer, along with Minister Wilson-Raybould, say that he's hopeful and optimistic. And the government is proud to be supporting Romeo Saganash's private member's bill to embrace the UNDRIP principles. But it's important to note that it's far too long that Indigenous peoples have been waiting for this moment where we finally shift attitudes, move away from words and into action. And the way that you do that, Dawn, is by recognizing that there is a recognition of rights approach. And what that means is not constantly forcing Indigenous peoples to prove that they have rights to land, rights to safe drinkable water, rights to education, rights to health like every other Canadians do, but to collaborate and to co-develop the type of policy frameworks that will provide those services to Indigenous peoples in a meaningful way. And that's what today's speech is about. It's about a catalyst. It's about writing a new chapter. And I'm very proud that our government is finally doing this.
Okay. I do want to move on because I got some other topics I want to get to before we let you go. The Canadian Forces Ombudsman yesterday was in front of a committee. And he's not terribly impressed. He says there's been at least 14 studies. Hundreds of recommendations have come and gone. Number of veterans on wait lists for disability benefits continues to get longer and longer and longer. Tracy, help me through this. Why are we keep studying this? Why is there no will to help veterans, or are they, you know, what's the cause here? What's the problem?
It's extremely frustrating to us, as well as it is to the ombudsperson, that we've had 14 studies, nearly 200 recommendations, none of which have been implemented. This is a serious issue. We cannot have the government standing up day after day saying that they stand up for veterans, they stand up for people who've served our country, but they are doing nothing about it.
Well,
these words are
this.
Not... These
There's
words,
a lot of money going into that, too,
But
though.
These words, you know, coming from the ombudsperson, are about frustration because the backlog of cases, the people who are not able to get through the system... This has to be fixed now.
Okay.
You know, we just before we came here, we voted on a private member's bill that was put forward by my colleague, John Broussard.
Yes.
It was a one-page private member's bill that would say that veterans would be treated with dignity and respect and in a timely manner and with fairness. Very simple.
That's all it said.
The Liberals voted it down. The NDP supported it.
Yeah.
The Liberals, and it was literally it was only one page. It was not a big bill. There was nothing partisan about it. Mm-hmm. Here's what we see over and over. The Prime Minister used veterans during the campaign. He put the promise, he put his own colleagues in the background and made a promise to veterans. He knew he did not have the ability to keep it and he was going to break it. I think what veterans are upset about is the disrespect. The disrespect not only as far as not getting the results that they were promised by this government, mm-hmm. but the disrespect like we saw in the town hall meeting where legitimate questions are being asked from our men and women who have served. So, you know, when the Liberals have a chance to actually act, like they did today, pass a very simple bill that would have said, let's treat our veterans with fairness, with dignity, with respect, and in a timely manner, they defeated it because that would have actually forced them to have made some changes.
Why did they defeat that bill? Just curious. Martha.
Well, due respect to John, and I know and I like him, this bill would not have accomplished anything. And just to set the record straight, and it's regrettable that we have to do this, and it's unfortunate when I hear my colleagues from the opposition side of the aisle simply refuse to acknowledge basic facts. $10 billion for a pension for life option. We have made enhancements to the pain and suffering awards. We've made enhancements to the income supplement awards. We have made investments to ensure that when somebody in the forces has completed their tour of service, that they are able to go back and get employment with counseling, with all of the supports they need to find employment. Those are the facts.
Okay,
we don't hear any acknowledgement there. So it's very
exactly.
unfortunate, but this is one of those, this is, sorry, if I could just be permitted to finish.
Yeah,
this is one of those issues where the opposition politicizes it at every turn, and it's got to stop.
The watchdog politicizes it.
I think what we would really, if the minister would stand up and say, You know, instead of yelling, and basically, even by that answer, what the Liberals are saying is, veterans, you've got nothing to complain about. Look at all the money we've thrown at you. That's not what they're asking for. So the Liberals, sure, they can criticize us, but you need to listen to veterans who want to know that they, even if you can't, if you're not going to give it to them, don't lie to them during the election campaign and then disrespect them.
We would never lie. And one of the things, one of the things that they said,
when veterans are here and veterans are coming to the government and saying, this is not a renewal of our lifetime pension. You are not standing up for us. The ombudsperson is saying we are not getting cases. Just simply, you know, talking about the things that you're doing is not acknowledging the lives of veterans in our country, and that's disrespectful.
One of the things that we heard during the election was, we want better services. Reopen the offices that were closed. Reopen the offices that were closed under the Conservative Harper administration. That was an important thing, and we did it from coast to coast. And we have made enhancements to the programs, which are all about giving the respect and the dignity that our service members deserve.
We have a motion tomorrow that we're asking the Prime Minister to apologize to the veteran that he spoke to in the town hall. Mm. And we're asking that he would answer to the veterans on the promise that he broke. If they can support that, if they actually mean what they're saying, support the motion. Again, I don't know why they didn't support the bill that John Broussard put forward. It's all talk.
There's now 29,000 veterans waiting for disability
benefits. And we are making great progress, and we'll continue to.
Marco, I don't know how you stand your riding in front of veterans and repeat that, because it's disrespectful to people who have served our country, given their lives.
It starts by acknowledging basic facts.
Okay.
We've already heard your basic facts.
Who visit the Hill.
Today, the Conservatives opened a new front in the House of Commons on pot. And I want to play a clip from the Deputy Leader taking on the Prime Minister. Here's what happened.
The Prime Minister said in legalizing marijuana that he was doing it because he wanted to keep organized crime out of the market. We're learning today of significant investments being made in Quebec cannabis companies by offshore accounts that have anonymous members. Can the Prime Minister give us assurances that these are not companies set up by organized crime?
Right now, the sale of marijuana across this country puts billions of dollars in the pockets of organized crime. That is a failure of the current actual system. We know that by legalizing and controlling the sale of marijuana, not only will we reduce the profits going to organized crime, street gangs, and gun runners, we're going to do a better job of protecting our kids and their communities with a legalized framework.
Margo, you're a Parliamentary Secretary of Justice. Are you concerned that some of this offshore investment that's coming in may be linked to organized crime, which is the whole reason, as the Prime Minister said, we're trying to legalize this stuff?
Well, our government is concerned that we have a system that currently doesn't work, and that's why we've introduced legislation to ensure that organized crime stops profiting from the sale of dangerous drugs.
Unless they reinvest.
Dangerous product. And the way to shift away from that is to introduce a new regime, which will ensure that we have strict regulation around the sale of cannabis.
How about the ownership?
And around ownership, look, we've got a very rigorous system in place when it comes to the exchange of stocks and investments, and we have to place some confidence in that.
So you're confident there's nothing to this allegation that this could be offshore money coming in that's got a
look, we have
criminality.
We have to place confidence in all of the oversight of our markets to ensure that there aren't any irregularities. But from the government's point of view, what's important is that the Senate continue its work so that we can move forward, as we have stated many times, with our intention to move to a new regime where we keep profits out of the hands of organized crime and keep dangerous cannabis out of the hands of our children.
This government has made a mess of legalization of pot. There have been concerns raised from everyone from police forces, law enforcement, to the medical community, to workplace safety. And the Liberals have ignored it because they have one goal in mind, and that's to rush this through so that they can say they fulfilled a campaign promise. This is where we have a lot of concerns about kids. We have talked about organized crime. And this reported story, whereby we not only have who knows who owns that, although we do know Liberal insiders, there's a lot of Liberal insiders that seem to be able to be making a lot of money off of this legislation.
That's a big concern.
Was he one?
Sorry, Marco. If I could finish.
Yeah,
and again, Instead of this government being responsible and saying, let's hold on and make sure we get it right, all they do is just keep defending. And who's going to suffer? Law and order, law enforcement, and our kids.
Last word to you, Tracy.
Two words, tax havens. If they would stop the tax havens, if they would actually implement some legislation, we wouldn't have $277 million coming into our country from who knows where, from who knows. We have a system that is full of holes like Swiss cheese. To say that this system is somehow preventing organized crime or who knows from putting money into our country is not the case. We need to end the tax havens, and they've actually signed more countries on to be able to do this. Canada's starting to become a place where you come and launder your money. That's not what we want to be known for.
We're out of time. Thank you. Interesting discussion. It wasn't about the Aga Khan holiday. We're all very happy about that. Just so you know, the Senate has basically put down the hammer, and they will be forcing a vote through on the marijuana legalization bill around March 1st. It looks like that's going to happen. All right. PowerPlay always welcomes your views on this or any other topic, so please reach out to us through social media on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or through email. Our address is powerplay@ctvnews.ca. Coming up, the Canadian view of free trade Trump troubles. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, the U.S. ambassador to Canada gave her first major speech last night in Ottawa, calling our relations with the United States vibrant and cooperative and as respectful as ever. She insists President Trump wants huge trade, really big trade, although she admitted he's not been very good at expressing how to achieve those results. This came the same day as Trump roasted Canada's trading behavior. Well, let's find out if these are negotiating tactics or a serious threat to NAFTA. Lawrence Herman is a trade lawyer and negotiator. He joins us from Toronto. I got to tell you, Larry, vibrant, cooperative, respectful, those words just don't roll off my tongue to describe the relationship. Does that sound like it to you?
It doesn't really. And certainly, I think the indications are that we're in for a rocky road with the Americans on a whole variety of fronts, the trade front being front and center. But I think that it's fine for the ambassador to try and kind of smooth things over. That's what ambassadors do. And that's her job. And, she's playing to a different audience. But the reality is that when it comes to the trade talks, which, you know, is the keystone of our relationship with the Americans, and these NAFTA negotiations, they're not going very well. And, our chief negotiator, Steve Verhul, gave a speech, a public speech, a couple of days ago at a seminar in Ottawa. It's crowded, the room was crowded. Obviously, he wouldn't have given such a blunt and somewhat gloomy portrayal of the prospects of dealing with the Americans unless his statement, I think, was approved by the Prime Minister's office. And what he said
basically, it's the worst he's ever seen in any trade deal offer. It's amazingly blunt talk.
Yeah, and I think it was important for him to lay out the basics of the negotiations and to tell Canadians and Americans that things are not going particularly well. There are some very, very difficult issues that have to be addressed, and the U.S. side has shown very little flexibility. And they put down some, not proposals, but positions that are essentially non-negotiable. So we have to kind of cut through the rhetoric that a diplomatic representative like the ambassador might provide, because she's trying to make the best of all possible worlds. But the reality is that it's not a very positive looking prospect. These negotiations are really, really difficult. And, at the end of the day, it's because the Trump policy is America first and America only. And it's pretty difficult to negotiate with, one side who says it's all about us, it's not about you.
Okay, but I'm curious what you make of the fact that, the U.S. trade negotiator was asked by Trump how things are going, give a summation. He said, things are going really well with Mexico. We're making progress. And then Trump unleashes on Canada, and you're going, wait a minute, when did we become the black hat wearing part of this three amigo combo? I mean, why have we suddenly become the target instead of the partner?
You know, I think a lot of this is gamesmanship. There's no question about that. And the president, you know, is a deal maker. And his approach is to make it tough on negotiating partners, to put them off stride. And that's what he's doing. But, I mean, again, all of that atmosphere, those atmospherics, all of that stuff, you have to put that aside and go down to where we are at the negotiating table. And at the negotiating table, things are not going well. My prediction, for what it's worth, Don, is that we'll have to take a breather and suspend these negotiations for a while. The Mexican presidential elections are coming up. The U.S. midterms are coming up. My sense is we won't get back to the table with the Americans for another year and see what we can do then. So we've got a lot of uncertainty ahead of us. That's my feeling.
Yeah, but, you know, the political side doesn't seem worried. They're not advancing a plan B. Should they be sort of suggesting, well, you know, maybe this is over. Maybe we have to find new partners. Or would that be kind of fatal to talks as well?
No, I don't think so. And in fact, I think Canada has found new trading partners. Look, we've got an agreement with the Europeans. It's a major agreement. And I think Canadians haven't realized how important that Canada-EU agreement really is. It opens up a huge market for us. And we're going to get a deal on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So we are cementing important trading relationships, showing that we're not totally dependent on the United States. That's been the problem for 150 years. We've been so dependent on that market. And when that customer turns ornery, as they have now, we suffer. So we've got some other irons in the fire, and I think that's a good thing. It reduces our exposure to the United States.
All right. Larry Herman, always a pleasure having you on. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Coming up, BC's political game plan veers away from fighting Alberta. Please stay with us.
I'm excited about the agenda we've laid out for the people of British Columbia, focusing on the things that matter most to them. Affordability is a top issue when I talk to people wherever I go, and on the top of that list of affordability is housing. I believe we've addressed in a comprehensive way where we're going forward in the next number of weeks and months.
That was BC Premier John Horgan following his government's second speech from the throne in the legislature yesterday. Many observers were wondering if he would confront the ongoing dispute with Alberta over building the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Well, let's find out if he did. Norman Spector has been Secretary of the Federal Cabinet on Federal-Provincial Relations under Brian Mulroney, amongst many other things he's done. He joins us from Victoria. Norm, I got to ask you, it seemed like Horgan's saying, you know, on this Alberta thing, crisis, what crisis? Nothing to see here. Is there a sign he's starting to surrender on this or back down?
He's certainly backing down a bit. I think that there's probably going to be a need for more movement on his part, and Ottawa is going to have to do his part because Premier Notley didn't seem to be terribly impressed by the little step that he took backwards yesterday. There's huge politics involved here for Horgan, for Notley, for Mr. Trudeau. There's his climate plan. There's huge bucks involved here. And if the federal government doesn't succeed in cooling this one off, we could have an all-out trade war, and we could have massive civil disobedience eventually in British Columbia. And given that Indigenous people are involved, we could even have a bit of a replay of OCA. So federal and provincial and BC officials are meeting today. It looks like they're going to try to put something together that might satisfy Premier Notley, and we may know more by the end of the day or tomorrow.
All right. Well, put me in that room, if you can use your imagination a bit. You've been around this track before. What might the federal government be able to dangle as sort of a peace offering to make BC back down on this threat to restrict the bitumen flow down the road?
Well, the federal government has huge leverage, and British Columbia is in need of significant resources for Mr. Horgan to fulfill the campaign commitments that he made in winning the election. We saw on Friday the federal government came through with $150 million in childcare funding. He needs a lot more than that. He needs more for housing. He needs more for transit. Those cards are there to be played. But given the politics involved here, as you know from Alberta experience, Premier Notley has been getting hammered over the past 2 years on this issue by the opposition, and she now has a united opposition. Premier Horgan made a commitment to fight the Kinder Morgan pipeline and winning the election, and he's supported by the Greens. And Mr. Trudeau's entire climate plan and all his boasting about being better at getting pipelines constructed than the late lamented Harper government was, all of that is on the table now. So you can be sure that the federal government is going to be using all its creativity, all its imagination, and all its resources to try to cool down this dispute.
All right. I don't want to get too hung up on this. I mean, it was a significant speech from the throne. Are promises going to be kept, or they be kicked down the road? What stuck out for you from the speech?
Well, he's taken baby steps there as well on daycare, on housing. We'll see more in the budget. But clearly he made a lot of, how shall we say, exaggerated promises in winning an election. The economy is still good here. The fiscal situation is still good, but he's already raised taxes in his initial budget document with the first throne speech after the election and budget after the election or budget update. He'll be raising further taxes as we go down the road. Some point, the economy is going to turn down, and that some point may become before his next election. So he's got his